Mr. McHackney will now read us a selection which he has written on the TB epidemics in those days and the treatment which was given to the patients.
This little piece involves not only people, but perhaps horses as well. The Richard Eady I'm referring to here is my grandfather, my maternal grandfather. Richard Eady was not a qualified veterinarian or horse doctor, as were usually referred to in those days. In fact, there was no one with a formal education on that line closer to Woburn, which is now Wyman, than Aylmer or perhaps Bytown. In fact, Richard Eady had very little education of any kind. He'd been born on the farm just west of Aylmer on April 6, 1816, the fifth child of Moses Eady and his wife Elizabeth Chamberlain. His father had come to the Aylmer district in 1805 from Randolph, Vermont. The Chamberlains left the New England state soon after and settled near the Eadys. Richard was 25 when he married Mary Wyman, daughter of Joseph Wyman, who had brought his family from Woburn, Massachusetts around 1830. The Wymans had settled briefly just north of Philemon Wright's new settlement of Hull, later moving to a farm just east of Aylmer. The family soon became very close friends, and Richard's oldest brother Edmund married the second Wyman girl, Hannah, soon after the arrival of the Wyman family at Aylmer, and took up land on the Upper Canada side just across the Ottawa River. Joseph Wyman and his son Joseph Jr. soon disposed of their holdings at Aylmer, securing a large tract of land about 25 or 30 miles to the west in the township of Onslow. This move was prompted by his desire, not only for land, but land with good timber on it, and it was obtained through the influence of their brother-in-law and Uncle Philemon Wright, who had achieved great distinction as a lumberman and a colonist since coming to Hull in 1800. When Richard Eady and Mary Wyman were married in 1841, they purchased a small farm about a mile or so from the London homestead at a place his father-in-law had appropriately named Woburn. Perhaps it was because of the limited amount of land he had, or perhaps it was because of his love for horses, as well as other animals, that he became known in the Woburn community as Horse Doctor Eady. He had an instinct when it came to diagnosing and treating most equine ailments, and of course his abilities in this regard filled a very definite need in this rapidly developing settlement. If his father having bone appeared to be in the early stages, he would apply a blister. And if the trouble was not too deep-seated, he could usually effect relief, if not a complete cure. Some troubles called for bleeding, and he always carried specialized for that purpose. He was adept at filing horses' teeth, a treatment frequently required. Sometimes he detected a case of heaves coming on, and he would leave the horse owner certain powders to be administered, but he always advised that in the case of heaves, prevention was better than cure. And he would warn against feeding musty hay or hard driving on a too full stomach, considered among the chief causes of that incurable condition known as heaves. All in all, his advice was considered valuable and his treatment usually effective, so his services were much in demand. On this particular May 3rd, 1858, he was driving home after spending the whole night with a farmer's mare and a newborn foal. He felt reasonably satisfied as he drove along in his road cart drawn by his reliable mare, Polly. The new foal had been born a bit weak, and although still very wobbly on the legs, was now able to stand alone, and was beginning to get the idea of where to look for that life-giving nourishment so necessary to the newborn animals. He'd stayed for breakfast with the grateful farmer and his wife, took another look at the new arrival and its mother, then hitched up Polly and headed for home. As he drove into his yard, his oldest son, Joseph, now 16, knowing that his father would be tired after being up all night, met him at the stable door, unhitched Polly, and put her in her stall. Joseph Eady gave every indication of being a born farmer, perhaps more particularly like his father, instinctively a horseman. The second son, Moses, 2 years younger, was quite the opposite. He was an artist with either paper and wood, and every spare minute he had, when not in school, he could be found in the shop in a woodshed loft where he had a wood lathe powered by a foot pedal he had rigged up. Every spare cent he could get, he spent on tools, and he now had a fine collection of saws, augers, and chisels. Or if he couldn't be found in the shop, he would likely be in the bedroom he and Joseph shared over the kitchen, which was a veritable studio. His older brother sometimes complained, not without some justification. There were easels and drawing boards, there was scarcely enough room left for the bed. Perhaps the rest of the family didn't know it, but Moses himself may have sensed the fact that he was destined to become one of the country's most famous architects. Richard and Mary had another son, Richard Jr., age 9, and 3 little girls. Susan, 7, Elizabeth, 4, and Lucy, just under a year old. So Richard gladly surrendered his house to his son, Joseph, entered the house with the idea of taking a brief rest on the couch before going out to work around the farm. For the land was drying up quite well, and he was soon busy seeding the field behind the barn to oats. But there were two reasons why we'd be prevented from getting much rest. In fact, the first reason was three reasons, and the farmer, 3 little girls, who were counting all of them as soon as you lay down on the couch. The other reason was that their sister-in-law, Sally Lyman, just at that moment drove into the yard. Joseph tied her horse to the hitching post near the kitchen door. As she entered the kitchen, Richard and Mary thought they detected a more solemn look than normal on her usually impassive countenance. They soon learned the reason. She told them briefly, "The boy is gone. I was with them all night, and he passed away just about dawn. Took another one of his bad coughing spells, this time worse than usual, and before I could waken Mrs. McGee and get her into the room, he was dead." The boy it referred to was really a man, 24 years old. Columbus Meeker, he was known as, although his right name was Charles Dumont Meeker. He had always been delicate and small for his age, at least ever since he'd come to live at Magoon's. Some thought he was a relative of Magoon's, and his parents were dead, but Mary or Sally weren't sure. Along with several other neighbor women, they'd taken their turns to sit up with him ever since he got really bad with the consumption. Other women who had helped out this way in order to give Mr. Magoon a rest included Mrs. John Davis, herself a Magoon, before she was married and went to live in the next farm, old Mrs. Craig, and Mrs. Robert Thompson, who lived just past over. Mary Evie had not been able to go up and sit with him as much as she would have liked on account of the 3 little girls, but she managed to go on a few occasions when she knew Richard would be at home. In later years, after her family could better spare her for a few hours at a time, she became known as the kind angel in the community, a reputation she was to carry to her grave in recognition of her many kindnesses shown to the sick and troubled in the district. During the past month, as a neighbor woman who had gone to sit up with the Meeker boy, which was nearly every night, it was her practice to improve their moments when he didn't require their immediate attention by sewing on some garment as they sat by his bedside. When it became evident that the end was near, their task turned to the making of the shroud that was to be the last garment he would be wrapped in before being carried to his final resting place. No doubt as he lay watching the well-meaning women sew on that piece of somber black, his eyes becoming more sunken, his breath becoming ever shorter, and his coughing more racking, he must have wondered what they were sewing, and why, as night succeeded night, did the next lady take up where the last one left off? Or did he really know? No one can be sure. Mama was sorry and informed it was all over. After he died, Mr. Magoon went over to see John Davis for help in arranging for burial. It had been discussed between the Davis and Magoon families that a plot would be laid out on one of the farms consecrated to that purpose, but nothing had been done as yet. So Sally Lyman returned without a decision being reached in that regard. She didn't know what to do, but told Richard and Mary that when Joseph returned home from Portage Floor, where he'd gone the day before to look after some timber operations he had going there, he would think it the proper thing to do. As Sally went out to get into her cart, they noticed Joseph coming down the road. Seeing Sally talking with Edie, she came in. When informed of the death of young Meeker and the need of a grave site, he thought for a few minutes. The others knew the always resourceful Joseph would come up with a solution to their problem. His mother had been buried in a special plot on the Wayman homestead almost 7 years before, and his father 2 years later had been laid beside her. There was no room there, and any way he expected their remains to be removed someday when a parish cemetery would be established. Joseph considered for a few moments, and then he said, "I think I have it. Down the road just below the turn of the mill pond, there's a steep hill right beside the road. It is very narrow on top, but plenty of room for a grave. Then the hill drops steeply on the other side to the Meadow Creek. I'll donate that piece of ground. No one will ever disturb him there, as it is not large enough to plow, not even for a potato patch." That afternoon, Joseph Wyman sent 2 of his men to dig a grave at the designated spot. The next day, Mr. Magoon and John Davis brought the body of young Meeker to this spot reserved for him alone. They were joined by Richard Eady, Joseph Wyman, and the Reverend Henry Hazard, recently appointed rector at the newly formed parish of St. John's in the Quayle. where the young man's body, wrapped in the shrouds so carefully made by the ladies who sat up with him every night, was reverently committed to the ground. To many, the event went unnoticed, to others soon forgotten. In years to come, as the company developed, that road just below where he lay became a busy thoroughfare. Hundreds were dragged by daily, not really realizing, and most of them not caring, that just a few feet from where they traveled lay all that remained of a young man who succumbed to a disease which had to take so many of his age in that era, and for many more years to come, before science and medicine was to discover that resignation to the dread and always fatal tuberculosis was not always necessary.
At the time, Mr. McKechnie, did any of the older people remark as to whether there had ever been flus before?
I don't think so. I think this disease was, in that form, was something unknown before in this country. Now, the settlers that we read about settling this country in the 1820s, but I don't think that was flu. They succumbed to a thing they called the bloody flux. And it hit them in summertime, and it was also a respiratory disease, I think, too. They couldn't get enough air in the deep bush and all this.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't contagious. It might have been, but... Well, the flu, as it was experienced in 1918, 1919, mm-hmm. was amusing, so far as I knew.
Was the bloody flux that you mentioned usually fatal as well?
No, not always, but some died with it.
Mm-hmm.
The piece I'm writing now on the settling of my parents, my great-grandparents in Lanark, showed that a lot of people had it, but none of them died with it, fortunately. But the neighbors had died with it.
And would your health be affected afterwards?
No, I think you recovered from it. If you read the history of Colonel Byrne building the Rita Canal, he had to clear out great swampy areas to let the air through so his men wouldn't die of this bloody flux. Now, I don't know what it means, whether they coughed up blood or...
Mm-hmm.
I think the way it affected people is a sort of a ague. They shook, they trembled, they had a fever,
mm-hmm.
and then it would pass away and they'd feel a little better and they need to come on the next day worse than ever.
I see. And could you tell me anything, Mr. McKechnie, about some of the early remedies or the ones that you remember from your days?
Well, I guess perhaps I was too bad to be sick when I was a kid, but I never had too much sickness. I was a bit of a scrawny young lad, I guess, but there was the usual remedies recommended, like sulfur and molasses and senna. Did you hear of that?
No.
It was something like a tea, you know, it gave them awful cramps and everything. And you've heard of salts.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they'd give them that, perhaps. And little pills and all sorts of stuff if they were upset or whatnot. But, there was a lot of home remedies, but, one of the worst things that affected them in those days was two things. This, especially for adults, would be typhoid fever and pneumonia.
Mm-hmm.
Now, typhoid fever, I believe, still exists, but it's chiefly due to bad water, eh?
Mm-hmm.
And the fellows coming down from the shanty, or the lumber camp,
mm-hmm.
or the drive, may be perhaps subjected to very poor living conditions and get some bad water and they'd come home and take typhoid fever. And they'd cut the hair off their head to save them from losing it because they'd have terrible temperatures and stress. And there couldn't be any fatalities with typhoid fever. Well, then there was pneumonia. And of course, even up to 50 years ago, I don't think there was any sulfur, perhaps only 25 or 30 years ago. I don't know when sulfur drugs come in. But they were the first drug. I'm no doctor, and I never had pneumonia. But I think sulfur drugs were the first effective drug to combat pneumonia. And then later they used penicillin, I suppose. But the treatment in the old days was to wring out blankets out of hot, steamy water and wrap the patient in it and sweat him. And get the window open, give them fresh air. It was a funny combination. I don't know how they didn't get more cold. And they worked ferociously at this. And the doctor would stay, nothing new for a doctor to stay for 7 hours with a patient if he had a bad case of pneumonia. The thing was to soften up this congestion of the lungs and get them breathing again. And I was drugs, you see, you don't have to do all that.
Right. It was practically a case of kill or cure in those days.
Well, possibly a bit of that, but I don't think the treatment ever killed anybody. If they could get this congestion loosened up, they'd likely save the patient.
Right. And pneumonia was called the old man's friend in those days. I've heard that.
The old man's friend?
Yes.
You need to kill them all quick.
That's what my grandfather had said, yes.
Well, for instance, and I suppose it's true yet, if a person, an old person, gets sick and goes to bed, they mightn't have a trace of pneumonia, but they're not able to get up. They're lying on their back. Their breathing is limited. Mm-hmm. And then they say, well, he just died in a day or two, took pneumonia. And I don't know whether it was a very friendly disease or not, but it sure knocked a lot of them off.
The idea, I guess, was that not as many people took the very dreadful...
The long, lingering disease.
Well,
you know, when I come to think of it, heart attack and cancer, when I was about it, seemed to be very rare diseases.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe they weren't diagnosed.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a man, some men, I think, died with heart trouble, and they said it was indigestion, pain there.
Mm-hmm.
But, oh, no, I'm sure there wasn't as much heart failure. I don't think there was attention.
And as well, people were probably eating less rich foods, which were better for them, maybe.
Well, I don't altogether agree with that, because there were some of the foods very rich. You take, for instance, the men in the lumber camps, they ate pork and beans, and that's pretty rich stuff.
Right.
But they were working in the open.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think that exercise for a man is a whole lot better than tension.
Right.
This rat race that people in offices and salesmen, various types of salesmen, engage in, and the drive that their company puts on them to produce,
mm-hmm.
that's an awful tension.
Right.
I would say that would be perhaps one of the causes of so much heart trouble today.
And do you have any memories, Mr. McCaffney, of the time of the Pontiac Hospital when you served on the board or in any other...
Well, when we come to the Pontiac Hospital, that's, we're getting to modern times, you see,
right.
My thinking, but perhaps before you were born, but then we had a hospital committee appointed, and I wasn't on the first committee at all. But they,
when was this, Mr. McCaffney? About what time?
I would think that the hospital was started up there. They bought that big house that used to belong to some prominent family in Charlotte.
Crawford at one time.
Yes, and those others too. But it was a very suitable building for the hospital, about a three-story building and close to the station, which was an asset in those days. And it served very well. I would think that hospital was started in the late 30s. Or perhaps the early 40s, or maybe somewhere in that time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's served very well, and of course we're always hoping to get a new hospital. And I wasn't particularly, well, I was interested in the hospital, definitely, because my wife had been a patient in that hospital a couple of times, and we're certainly very grateful to have the accommodation there and the service. But the directors were appointed then partly by annual meeting, which all met. Members were entitled to attend, or all citizens were entitled to attend. It was, I doubt if there was a hospital ever organized on the same basis as this was, because most hospitals, particularly in this province, are organized by some religious order or something by the government, and this was organized just by a committee of citizens, becoming members, appealing to county council, and to various councils such as Shawville or Clarendon or others around, and to the government for some only getting small grants. And in those days, the federal government wasn't involved in hospitalization at all. They didn't involve themselves with it, I mean. They do now, giving a grant so much a bed, you see. Well, it was a struggle to get that hospital. It operated very well. The matron, or superintendent, whatever you might call her, she was chief clerk and everything else, and she'd have a few, she'd have a cook, and there's a few registered nurses and some nurses' aides. And that hospital functioned very well, but it wasn't big enough. So we tried to get the new hospital going. while we're still in the old hospital there at the station, the way I happened to get on it was that the county council was supporting the hospital fairly generously, and they nominated a director. Ever since the start of the hospital, Dr. Herdman of Bison represented the county on the hospital. First of all, he was secretary treasurer of the county, and he was a medical man, and he was a natural representative for the county to have on the hospital board. Well, then Dr. Herdman retired as secretary, and he was getting old. He retired as secretary of the county, and he wished to be replaced as a representative on the hospital board. So the county council appointed me in, I think I have it here somewhere, I think I was appointed in 43. I was appointed in May 1943 to succeed Dr. Herdman. And I sat with the board there for seven on the board, I think. And then after that, we come up for election or re-election every spring when the meeting was out. Well, we started negotiations for government grants and money to start a new hospital. And I was on the board when the new hospital was built in 47. You know, before those hospitals were in existence there, I'd say before 40, people either had to go to Pembroke or to Ottawa or Ann Prior or stay at home. And I would think that prior to the opening of the first Shovel Hospital, that 90% of the babies in this country were born in the homes. We'd have to talk to some nurse or some midwife about that, but I'm sure of that. And then, of course, if a boy or something had appendicitis, we had a boy one time with appendicitis, where the boy had a broken leg, well, the only thing could get them to Ottawa Hospital. And after I got my car, my first car in 27, I took several neighbors, youngsters, to the Civic Hospital or some hospital in Ottawa. And that's what you had to do. It was an emergency, like, it had to have an operation. But once we got our own hospital, some of our doctors were able to do these operations or bring up a specialist from the city.
Right. Mm-hmm. What about the very first hospitals, Mr. McKechnie, both the one in Dr. Powell's house and the one in the old Shaw building? To what extent did they amount to?
I don't recall what about anything in Dr. Powell's house. He had a big house and he may have kept some patients there. The one you refer to, the Shaw building, is that building on Main Street, eh?
Yes.
Well, I remember taking a boy up there for appendicitis from my neighbor right near home there, and taking his parents up. So there was an operation there. I think Dr. Mendel was the man who performed that operation. It had its limitations on account of its size, but it served a very good purpose for a few years until they located in the big building up near the station.
So it would have been started in the early 30s, approximately.
I would imagine in the mid-30s. I don't know how long that run. There was a Mrs. Sousley Hodgins.
Yes, I believe.
And she was a nurse, and she was instrumental in supervising that, and was there on a full-time basis, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yes, but the staff there was very small, and the space was limited.
Mm-hmm.
But it served a purpose. It was just all a matter of the evolution of the Shovel Hospital. Now I understand we're going to get a new wing for chronic patients,
mm-hmm.
as well as hopefully a new home for the aged in the same area there.
It's a marvelous progress to make within.
You said 35. In 35 or 40 years.
Right.
Tremendous. And of course, like everything else, the changes over the last 35 or 40 years, it's just terrific. I remember speaking to your group of graduates, Susan, I think I made the remark that in my 70 years that I could remember, there are more changes have taken place than any other 70 years in the world's history. And I made that remark to several people, and they agree with me.
Mm-hmm.
But even of those 70 years, I think the last 40 have been the most outstanding.
Finally, Mr. McKechnie, a little bit about what life was like in the early home.
We made what we called a leech. A leech, L-E-A-C-H, means leaching, means putting water through it and it leached out. Well, we set up this barrel on a little sloping platform with a little groove under it, and it would be filled with ashes. You'd set it in a slope in such a way with a little trough from it, and then you would put some water on the top of it. Every day, hollow it out a little bit on top, funnel shape, and you put in a pail of water. And that would gradually seep through the ashes, and it would come out the bottom dry, just about the color of maple syrup. And you had to be mighty careful to, I know of one kid that got badly burned by mistaking it for maple syrup. It was just brown like that. And this lye came down through there. And you gather these pots of lye. You keep on putting in water until the good soap maker could tell when the ashes was finally leached out and drained of its vitality or whatever it is. Usefulness, and they get another barrel of ashes, which they'd have lots of them around, and they'd gather up this lye. You put on a great big cooler. You know what a cooler is? It's a great big iron pot that hung across a pole with a fire under it, and they would boil this lye and put chunks of soap into it. Now, I'm no expert, but I just saw it done, and my chief job would be to help make the leech, keep the water in it, take away the lye, and keep the fire under the cooler. But I do know that after a certain boiling and processing, they let the fire die out, and that would harden into soap. Now, there was two kinds of soap. There was soft soap, which was a gruely, burnish, like thick gravy. But then there was another method, and I don't know what they did to do it, but it would come out in big, just off-white, hard, firm chunks. And we never were down to this severe straits. We had to use that for washing our hands and face, but some people did. It was very good for washing clothes. Then, as a small boy, I remember the laundry soap coming in and wrapped in paper, and it was pretty grim stuff too, you know, scent to it, and none of this powdered soap. It was in bars. And we usually bought that, but our housekeeper that we had, my mother was dead, and we had a housekeeper. And she always liked to make some soap. And usually the hard soap, it was better soap. And even up to a few years ago, you know, there was classes at our local fairs for this homemade soap. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of an art.
Right.
That was one thing they did. And of course, another thing that was very common in those days, and they, people, you know, how many farms today even got hens on.
Mm-hmm.
And every farm had a few hens, and long before we'd incubators, those chickens were hatched on the farm. And that was the women's work on the youngsters. And we'd gather the eggs, and we'd, after a hen would lay certain lengths of time, some breeds of hens were worse for this than others, they'd get what they called broody, and they'd want to sit. They wouldn't lay anymore. It was just nature exerting itself on them, and they would want to. Oh, our housekeeper, she knew the good hens from the poor ones, and it had to be a nice, quiet hen. And you'd put a dozen or 15 eggs under a hen, and she'd sit for 3 weeks and bring out 2 eggs, and that's the way you perpetuated the hen population.
Mm-hmm.
And you could raise them, the hen would be put out in a little coop in a little yard, and finally they were let go. If they survived the skunks and the foxes and the hawks, you'd have a flock of chickens for the fall. And that was all work, wasn't it? And a sort of an intensive sort of work. You couldn't do it on a grand scale until incubators came in. And I don't know how long incubators were invented, but I sure remember when we got our first one. And of course now we wouldn't even be bothered with an incubator. If you didn't want to go into the chick business, you'd buy baby chicks from a big commercial outfit. But in those days, everybody raised a few chickens at home.
So the housewife at that time really had to be skilled in many.
Yes, and quite often she was called on to help with the milking. Our housekeeper were never asked to do the milking, but in some homes in the early days, well, not such early days, in the after the turn of the century, up to 1920 or 20, they considered milking was beneath the man. And the women would do the milking, and they'd save the milk. probably would go to the cheese factory. And then the cheese factory, because most people only milked their cows in summertime when the grass was good, and they let them dry for the winter. And so the cheese factory would close about October, and then you'd keep the cows milking for a while longer to get enough butter for the winter. And before the days of cream separators, and I can remember before cream separators, I think we got our first one about 1909 or 10, maybe a little before that, maybe 1907. Mm-hmm. But before that, the milk was put into pans and put in the cellar in a cool place or in a milk house, which is cool, dug out of the side of a hill. And in order to keep out anything you didn't want in it, it was hung on shelves, and that was well protected from anything that might be in the cellar. And then you went down with a sort of a skimming thing, and you skimmed the cream off after about 12 hours or 24 hours, and you heated that up, you gave that skim milk to the pigs or whatever, and you saved that cream, and you churned. And it would take, nobody milked much more than 10 or 12 cows, so it'd take a while to gather up a bunch of cream. Then the cream was gathered, preferably in a stone crock. You know what I mean, that's earthenware stuff. And then it would be soured slightly and brought to a temperature of 60 or 62 degrees. That was the ideal churning temperature. Then it put into the old churns that, we never had a dash churn. That was a thing that plunged up and down, you know. That was a slower way, but we had a churn you turned. It was a crank and floppity-flop, floppity-flop. And if the cows were on the right kind of feed and they were in the right kind of humor and it wasn't bewitched, as the old people used to say it might be, cream used to get bewitched by some people, idea, and it would break, as they call it. That is, you know, cream is made and milk is made of little globules of fat. Mm-hmm. And they burst open and then you have butter and buttermilk instead of cream. And they drew the buttermilk off, they washed that with cold water, they worked it with a ladle, and worked salt into it, and put it away for the winter in crocks or in prints. And that was done, and we did that long after we were married in 1921. I'm sure we made that, now we quit doing that. Then cream separators come in, it was much more efficient way of getting the cream from the milk. It separated right on the spot when it was still warm. The skim milk was still warm to feed the calves. Didn't matter for the pigs, but the calves had to have their milk warm or they had sickened them. They wouldn't take cold enough. And so everybody, that was the time of mixed farming, because it called for mixed farming. Today with these modern things, the demand is for specialized farming. You're either in dairy or you're in beef or you're in poultry or whatever. And one doesn't dovetail into the other the way it did then. The byproducts then were fed to some other class of stock, you see.
Right. Could you tell me a bit, Mr. McKechnie, about the prints? Now, I've heard them mentioned, but I'm not just sure what they were.
Well, I think maybe you saw them up at the exhibit at the museum at Shawl that time. But a butter print was a little square wooden box about the size of a pound of butter it is now. And it was sort of collapsible, and there was a handle went through a hole in the sand, and you filled that full of butter. You had to have it dipped, I think, in water first. I forget whether it was cold water or hot water. But you packed the butter into it, and then you give it a shove, and it came out just in approximately a pound of print. Then, of course, they had nice little round prints, half pounds and quarter pounds, and they were a little more decorative, you know, and Scotch thistle, and I wish I had kept ours, but we had a lovely one with the Scotch thistle on it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were for your own use. You could sell prints. Then some women that didn't have a print, or some people preferred making it in rolls. Mm-hmm. They would pat it together in a nice little roll as twice the size of a brick, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Probably 5 pounds of butter, four pounds. Or some packed them directly from the after being churned and washed, they pack it directly into a crock. Crocks of all sizes, 5, 10, 30 pounds. We usually put it away in crocks for the winter, and you make it just a little saltier than you'd want it, and it sure kept good. It was lovely butter.
Do you remember, Mr. McKechnie, or would you be able to tell me, Which was the more common kind of churn? Now, I've also heard dog churns mentioned.
Well, they were very old. The people that lived on this farm many years ago had a dog churn and remains of it around here. And I hope to go over to Middleville to their big parade next Monday, which is always their big day over there, civic holiday in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
And we were over there 3 years ago, we saw a dog churn. But that was just a method of power.
Right.
I was the power that usually turned our churn. And it wasn't it was a job you didn't like very well.
My grandfather said they used to have a dog churning. He can remember that on churning days when the dog saw his mother getting the churn out, the dog would, if you didn't catch the dog in time, he'd
grown off. They'd go, well, I don't blame them a bit. And believe me, there were days when I could see the housekeeper getting the cream ready. I felt like going and hiding.
You also mentioned, Mr. McKechnie, that it was stored in a stone crock if possible, or if one was available. What was the particular advantage of that?
It seemed to keep with a better flavor than if it was stored. Another source of storing and taking it to be sold was wooden pails or firkins. They're made of wood staves, like a small wooden barrel, and they might be in 10 or 30 pound sizes.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd probably line them with butter paper. And you'd take that to the store and exchange it for groceries.
Right.
That was the way many people got their groceries. And I'm telling you, if the wife couldn't, the wife in the home couldn't keep the place going with eggs and butter, she'd run a hard chance, a very poor chance of getting her money out of the crusty old farmer to run the house, because he needed that money to buy machinery and binder twine and whatnot. And so that the homes were, you see, the farms in those days were pretty well self-sustaining.
Right.
Taxes were low, and the things that a house wife needed money for chiefly was, the biggest thing would be sugar and butter, sugar and flour. And even before that, earlier that, people grew a little wheat and would take it to the mill and get it exchanged for flour. But that pretty well died out when I was a very small boy.
Mm-hmm.
And so we bought our flour, we bought our sugar. We'd have to buy some coal oil for all coal oil lamps, but that wouldn't be a very big item.
Mm-hmm.
You have to buy a bit of salt.
Mm-hmm.
It took quite a bit of sugar because they preserved a lot of fruit in those days.
Mm-hmm.
It was the poor housewife that didn't have 100 jars of fruit in the basement at this time of year,
mm-hmm.
A little later.
Mm-hmm.
There'd be all the various things, strawberries, rhubarb, first thing of all, eh? They took quite a bit of sugar.
Right.
And then there was strawberries, and then they'd pick raspberries, and the kids would all be out and pick raspberries. We'd go to the mountain and pick the blueberries,
mm-hmm.
and that was a bit easier. And then there'd be the blackberries in the fall, there'd be apples, you'd make applesauce, or you'd preserve apples and put them down. Some people even dried apples.
Mm-hmm.
That was a technique of its own, I don't know much about it, but it was done. They would, plums, it was wild plums to pick. There's very little of this thing of buying fruit to put up. Now we find that a great many people don't even buy fruit on the market and put it up. They buy jam all winter.
Mm-hmm.
And it can't be compared to the home preserved fruit.
No.
Berries or plums or peaches and pears. That's got everything else
mm-hmm.
skinned.
Always.
Another thing that was used a lot in those days, of course, was the various kinds of syrup. Black molasses was used especially in wintertime for with bread for dessert after you.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a corn syrup of some kind. Of course, anybody that had a sugar bush had maple syrup.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all such eating as yet.
Right. And it was a great sweetener as well.
Yes, it was used. A good many people boiled it right down to sugar and used the sugar and it had a distinctive
mm-hmm.
flavor.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of sap, though, to make a pound of maple sugar.
Mm-hmm.
So we preferred, when we did it, to make it into syrup.
Mm-hmm.
Tea would have to be bought. That was, everybody drank tea, and it was usually green tea,
mm-hmm.
until the Second World War, you know. Could,
mm-hmm.
And we preferred the green tea now. I don't think I could drink it at all. But everybody, and it'd be a common thing for people in the fall to buy a caddy of tea.
And what would
a caddy be? A caddy is a square box lined with lead foil, you know,
mm-hmm.
and it would be about, oh, much bigger than an egg crate. You don't know perhaps what an egg crate is.
No.
It would be perhaps a foot and a half square.
Mm-hmm.
I made a thin, thin wood and came from Ceylon or Japan or China or wherever the tea came from.
And about how tall? Oh, a foot and a half square.
About a foot and a half every way.
Right.
Roughly. Mm-hmm. Made out of late wood and lined with this lead foil.
Did the housewives do much drying of vegetables?
Well, I mentioned not that much. Some of them dried apples, but no, I don't think there'd be too much. Not in this country.
And was meat usually salted?
Meat was usually salted. You could kill a pig and salt at any time, see? In the wintertime, you'd perhaps kill a beef and keep it frozen. Because it didn't have any deep freezes, we didn't have electricity, we didn't even have the lockers in the villages that we had later. So, killing a pig or two every fall, and of course there was also, speaking of killing pigs, a great many people, a little before my day, but about that time, a lot of people killed meat and killed pork and took it to the market, commencing in the wintertime, right in autumn. Drove down the ice or down there, or what?
And what would the root houses be used for, Mr. McKenzie?
That'd be for keeping, say, carrots or turnips in, or potatoes.
Mm-hmm.
Potatoes were something put in a pit. Mm-hmm. We never had a pit because we had a good cellar, but if you didn't have a cellar, you would dig a hole in a sandy place in the ground and perhaps on top of the hill, and you'd put in your potatoes and you'd cover them over with straw, and you wouldn't touch that till the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Then you dig them out and use them for seed or eat them, and sometimes it's spoiled. But a root house, we always had a good cellar at our place, so we didn't have to use root houses or potato pits.
And could you tell me just a little bit more, Mr. McCaffney, about what life was like in the early homes, if you can remember what the general fare as far as food was concerned?
Well, in our home, we were Scotch descent and porridge was a must. And toast, we always had porridge and toast, and in our home we never ate much meat for breakfast, but some people did, and there might be a little jam and the usual thing for breakfast, and in those days we didn't have much coffee, but any milk or tea we'd be drinking. I don't know just what else.
Potatoes would be a great
thing. Yeah, some people like potatoes for breakfast.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then at dinner time, at lunchtime, I suppose, noon, midday meal, potatoes and meat were the staples, and perhaps one vegetable if you had it.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't always have it. We were pretty good on pie. They made lots of pies in those days because the fat was lard or whatever it is you put into pies for shortening was produced right on the farm. And perhaps so was the apples, stuff you put into it. So we had lots of pies and the pudding. We ate a good substantial midday meal. I would say in those days the midday meal was no lunch, it was the main meal. It was quite common in those days to have supper, particularly at certain seasons of the year around 4 o'clock, and the men on the farm would go out and eat after. You know, the supper might be it'd be a little more quickly prepared meal. It'd be perhaps warmed up potatoes, cold meat, and some tea, and maybe some. Then you'd use some of these canned or preserved raspberries or strawberries or something for some dessert. And they'd go out and they'd work till nearly dark if it was haying or seeding time. Then the main thing at night at our place was a snack of bread and milk before you go to bed. Now, you were wondering when they had the fun, eh? Well, you think that wasn't much fun. And it wasn't either. But wet days, the boys, and there were 3 or 4 boys in our home, they'd like to get into the hayloft, and they'd spar, and they'd wrestle, and they'd have fun, and of course my father always figured that wet day was a great day to clean the granary and do all the odd jobs in the barn that had been neglected. That wasn't too popular with the young fellas, but it had to be done. Oh, sure, they went fishing, and they quit early some nights. I was talking there a minute ago about seeding and haying time, one of the busiest times. And they had their fun, and they went on picnics, and I think they took more time for picnics. I can remember when I was a boy, several years, we'd take 2 or 3 express loads of people. You know what an express is? It's a big double buggy. You'd hold about 9 people, or 6 people anyway, and take a team and go to the mountain and pick berries. And that was almost as good as a picnic. We'd take our lunch, we'd eat out there, and we'd drive home at night with several plates of blueberries. There's other to it. I have a poem here written by an uncle of mine. It was what they did in the, this long before I was born, more than 20 years, in the summer of 1876, and that's the way he entitled it. Now, he wasn't as good a poet as one of my aunts was on the other side of the family, but he's fairly good. And he wrote this poem reminiscing of what they did in the summer of 76, or 75, I forget it. And it was very good. They took lots of trips. And they went many miles. They had good driving horses. Mm-hmm. And they would go to a picnic. The occasion might be Shawville Fair, it might be 12th of July, it might be go over to the Shaw Falls for a picnic when the Shaw Falls was still running open. Mm-hmm. And it was a lovely place for picnics, so they said. Well, I remember that. I remember long before the dam was built. And so they had the good times too. Mm-hmm. But in the long winter evenings, it was a little bit try and get the children. I mentioned before about them making up the butter in the fall for the cow. And there wasn't many cows milking in the wintertime, perhaps one. And so he didn't have that much work in the evenings, long days. So the days were, the evenings were long. Mm-hmm. There was perhaps an open-air rink. I can remember often when I was 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, we'd walk 2 or 3 miles to an open-air rink, skate all night and then walk home. Some people took a horse, but we never seemed to have one for it. We could walk, and we're a good walker. Mm-hmm. Okay. And of course, there were sliding parties. There was a good sliding party, sliding hill right on this farm. Mm-hmm. We used to have toboggan parties there, and mm-hmm. come in and have, they do that yet, eh? Right. But something like the skiing or skidoo parties, but we slid in a toboggan. Mm-hmm. Had to walk back up the hill, but that was lots of fun. And nearly every community had a baseball team or a football team, and they'd get together in the evenings in the summer when they weren't too busy haying or something. They were fun in those days.
Right. What about the church activities, McKechnie? Did the churches sponsor social gatherings?
No, they didn't. I can't remember of a church sponsoring very much until I was about 20 years of age or more. In the late, or later, there was a church up in Bristol, which is now St. Andrew's United Church, but used to be a Presbyterian church there, and there was a minister there by the name of Mr. Harris, and he sponsored semi-social educational activities. He and his wife were good organizers, and he organized what he called the Young Men's Bible Class, and she organized what she called the Girls' Guild. And although I didn't belong to that parish, I went there to take advantage, not to church, but to these activities, and I was welcomed. Mm-hmm. And these were partly social and partly educational. For instance, he would organize what they call an agricultural short course in the spring, mm-hmm. and he'd bring very good speakers in, and would have it for about a week at 2 or 3 different farms where the stock was suitable for judging, and mm-hmm. judged grains and clover seeds, and it was very good. Mm-hmm. We weren't paid to do it the way they are now, Tanya. Mm-hmm. We went at our own expense, and these men came from the experimental farm, McDonald College, mm-hmm. and the local agronome, you see, would help. And another thing that he would sponsor was debates, and I don't know whether that I became permanently afflicted or not, but I learned to talk a bit there. I liked debating, and he would have a lot of these debates, and occasionally, of course, would get together for a social evening with the girls, because you can't keep them apart all the time, eh? And the Girls' Guild and the Young Men's Bible Class would get together and for a social evening, or even debated one another sometimes. No, I wouldn't say that the churches took much interest in social activities until that time.
Were the churches very, very strict as to what could be done on Sunday?
There were, either the churches or the people. When I was a boy, I was caught swimming once on a Sunday, and I got bawled out for it. And I think I needed to swim too. It was a hot day in summer. And yes, I was severely reprimanded. Mm-hmm. And I was probably 11 or 12 years old at the time, or maybe more. I sure was. And now it's nothing. We have a cottage now at Narrow Bay, and we'll ask the minister and his family to come up and spend the afternoon with us, and we'll all go in swimming. Mm-hmm. So you see, attitudes have changed completely. I think perhaps we're a little too permissive in some things now, certainly, and it's getting more so. Mm-hmm. But we certainly were too strict and rigid in those days.
some swing back was needed. Do you remember anything, Mr. McCackney, about the traditional Saturday night preparations for Sunday?
Well, the one thing I read about was, have you ever read Ralph Connor's book? Now, Ralph Connor was the pen name for W.C. Gordon, who was a Presbyterian minister down in the Glengarry country, and he wrote some very good books. And I think his first book was Glengarry School Days, and the next one was The Man from Glengarry. And I think it was in one of those books that he referred to, he was a product of the manse himself. His father was a minister, at least perhaps his hero was, I guess, that was it. And he mentioned how Saturday night you could feel the Sabbath coming on. Mm-hmm. Now, this was written before the turn of the century, or about that time. And that I never experienced that. Mm-hmm. Saturday night in this area was a time for cutting up a wee bit. And until about 4 or 5 years ago, or 10 years ago, when was it, that the stores used to be open Saturday night till near 12 o'clock, but they couldn't get people out of town.
Mm-hmm.
In Cuyo and in Shawville and everywhere else. Mm-hmm. Now they changed it to Friday night and they close at 9.
Right.
It's shop or else. But in those days you just couldn't get the stores closed. And Saturday night, I remember when the store closed the Shawville stores in Cuyo and Shawville, particularly Shawville on Saturday night, and said we're going to have it open Friday night. The people in some areas thought they'd die if they couldn't get to Shawville Saturday night. And now they close at 5 o'clock Saturday, I guess. And we had a local store here, and a very good one at Wyman, an excellent store, run by two or three different families, but one family ran it for perhaps over 50 years, and they run an excellent store.
Mm-hmm.
And they never closed at night till about 9 or 10 o'clock.
And it was a social gathering point.
It would be.
Right. I remember the time when I was fairly young, but I do remember that changeover from Saturday to Friday night shopping. And even while shopping was on Friday night, for a number of years, it was considered very important that you would go out to town on Friday night. Everybody met. Everybody was there. It was a social occasion.
That's right. You exchanged views. And
mm-hmm.
I don't think that still exists so much.
Well,
there's no place in the store now to sit down.
No.
And there's very few places outside to sit down. They have one place up there in Shawville.
Mm-hmm.
But now the stores want you to go in, pick up your card, go around and get your stuff, pay your bill and get out.
Right.
And that wasn't the attitude in those days.
No.
People sat and stood in the store and told, but the storekeeper got all this information that way. And then he passed it on to the next people. Sure.
Could you tell me, please, Mr. McCackney, about the farm activities at that time, hay and that sort of thing?
Well, I mentioned before that the women in most farms did the milking and looking after that, but in our place, the men did it, mostly. But the haying was done quite differently than now. It was, of course, the first thing you did in the spring was the seeding. You'd hoped of your work, your farm all plowed the fall before. It was all horse work. And probably only a one furrow plow, but you're trying you'd get your seeding done as quick as possible. Haying was done with a horse-drawn mower, about a 5 foot cut, some of them a 6 foot cut, and then you would just rake it with a dump rake, which wasn't very, and it would be coiled. Now coiling is putting up in little piles to cure, and then it was drawn in, forked onto a hay rack by hand, and the man on the ground farting it on, and the man on the wagon would drive the team and stop at every coil and build his load. You take it in, and if you were lucky, you had a hay fork, which was a two-pronged apparatus pulling it up into the loft with ropes. And the modern barns of the 20s and 30s had a good long hay fork track in them, and that's the way you got in your hay. And if you had some good man, you could put in quite a bit of hay in a day, too. You'd average a load an hour, or maybe a load every 3/4 of an hour if it wasn't too long a haul.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just, these hay forks were pulled by perhaps a single horse driven by a child or a woman or an old man that happened to be around. So they got the work done with not too much labor.
And what about bringing in the grain?
Well, the grain, I don't remember the reapers, but the binders come in much before my time.
And then
the grain was cut with a binder, and it was stooped, and I did a lot of stooping. And then it was stooped up and left for about a week.
Mm-hmm.
no combines in those days. In fact, farmers would hoot at the idea of a combine in those days charging it right out of the field.
Mm-hmm.
They'd think it was too much waste. I doubt it was much more waste with a combine than it was then, but it was